The gospel reading is John 11:32-44. My primary text will be the Revelations text. Revelation. It's Revelation is not plural. Neither is there is a book of Psalms, but the individual psalm you just say Psalm. It's not Psalms 100. It's Psalm 100. But the resurrection of Jesus, which is anticipated in the raising of Lazarus, is what makes everything in Revelation 21 possible. So I'll read the gospel, but I won't comment on. I don't think. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, and you know, again, the context is Lazarus is dead, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said, "Lord, come and see." So Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he have opened the eye, he who opened the eyes of the blind man could have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, already there's a stench, because he has been dead for 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did not I tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, "Father, I thank you for having heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Then the epistle, Revelation 21, 1 through 6. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'See, the home of God is among mortals.'" I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version, if you're curious. "He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples." Interesting, plural, peoples. "And God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. And the one who was seated on the throne said, 'See, I am making all things new.' Also he said, 'Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true.' Then he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life.'" Well, I guess everybody wants to go to heaven. I don't know of anybody who wants to go to the other place. The other place is not very popular. Although some of the redneck boys and girls that I went to high school with in Adrian, Georgia would say, "Well, I know I'm not going to make it to heaven, so I guess I'm going to go where all my friends are going. I'll have a lot of friends there, you know." I think that's an unfortunate result of the church at the time making people feel like Christianity was boring and it was not a place where you could find fun. And if you were into fun, well, you were bound for hell. And I guess the Baptist churches I grew up in certainly certainly painted that picture. Yeah, I'm going to go where all my friends are. But I think everybody has their own views of what heaven is going to be like, don't they? We all have our own views, because I hope you all know, and I think you do, that when the Bible speaks of heaven, and notice the text today actually is technically talking about the New Jerusalem, which hasn't come yet, but we think of it as this is a depiction of heaven, so where are the saints who are with God now if that's not the New Jerusalem? See, it gets all kind of murky, doesn't it? And that's because we are talking about the next life. And when we talk about the next life, we, you know, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12, when he speaks of this man who we think was him, was caught up to the seventh heaven. I can't count much past 10. So it's, was it the seventh heaven? You're looking at me like, preacher, you should know. Anyway, look it up. It's in 2 Corinthians 12. He said, I saw things that's not just permissible for a man to speak about. And so we say that it's a place with pearly gates and streets of gold and the walls are filled with priceless jewels. And you know, should we take this literally? I don't know. Maybe we can. But even if it's a metaphor, it's a metaphor that's saying this beautiful beyond human description. So we don't know. We don't know all about it. Everyone, as I said, has their own views about it. You know, you hear people say, and you hear like in gospel songs, you know, when I get to heaven, I'm just going to run all around it when I first get there. Well, I mean, we don't know. There may be signs in heaven that say no running, you know. in heaven, you wouldn't want to trip up people, you know, so there may be no running signs. And, you know, well, the first person I talk to in heaven is going to be my mama. Well, she very well may be there, but, you know, who knows? You may have to stand in line or something. You know, you may have to be processed. No, that sounds like hell, doesn't it? Government bureaucracy. But I'm just saying that we don't exactly know what it's going to be like. In any event, though, there are many wonderful things we can say about heaven. And is it, as you read the rest of chapter 21, that's where we get into the various jewels and, you know, the walls of jasper and all that, which is just to say, as I just said, that it's going to be beautiful beyond human description. Human words aren't enough to say what heaven is going to be like. So we talk about it in terms of analogy, just like we talk about God in terms of human analogy, because we just don't have the adequate language to express what an infinite holy being is really like, since we are mortal and finite creatures. But notice is also described as a bride, the New Jerusalem coming down adorned as a bride for her husband. Now, this is kind of confusing in a way because the church is also described as the bride of Christ. But what do we think of when we think of brides? We think beautiful, we think pristine, we think of somebody who has traveled all over the country just to find the perfect dress and has driven her mother crazy, you know, by this time. But, you know, that's what we think of when we think of brides, you know, the ideal of the virginal bride, which is today is almost a myth, I think. But anyway, it's a bride. And if you think of the people who will constitute the New Jerusalem, the church as the bride, because we are called the bride of Christ in the New Testament. And isn't that funny? No matter how sinful we are, no matter how many mistakes we've made, no matter how much violence we have committed against one another, how much we have hurt people beyond measure, when Jesus looks at us, he sees us as a beautiful bride because of his grace and mercy and the forgiveness that comes through his atonement. He doesn't see that. Once we've come to Christ, he sees us as a bride. I think that's amazing. But perhaps the most significant thing about the New Jerusalem, heaven, whatever you want to call it, is this one verse in this text for today. The dwelling or the home of God is among mortals. The dwelling of God is among mortals. Beyond the jasper walls, beyond the gates of pearl, beyond all the priceless jewels that are embedded in the wall, beyond the immense size of the city of the New Jerusalem and the height of its walls and whatever, is the fact that the dwelling of God is among mortals. God has come to live with God's people. Now, I know you're saying, and you're right, well, Jesus, God, already lives in our hearts. That's true. We already have a relationship with God. That's true. But right now, we are in a finite state. We are in a mortal state. And we cannot apprehend and relate to God in all of God's glory and holiness. You know, the Jews felt that if mortal man saw God, came into direct contact with God, he would die. Well, we've got that taken care of, because at this point we'll all be dead. So, and resurrected. So we'll have gotten the dying part taken care of. And at that point, as beings of spirit, or having resurrected bodies like Jesus' body, we will be able to stand to be in God's presence with no veil, no barrier, no holy of holies, nothing. We will be in this is the phrase I like, the unmediated presence of God. And by God's grace, we will be able to tolerate it. But God's presence, that's what makes it heaven. Heaven is where God is. And that's what is going to make all these other things possible, because everything's all right in the presence of God, you see. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Lo, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world. When we are in the presence of God, everything is all right. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things shall be well. In the direct presence of God. And that, to me, is the key to this passage. Because it is because God is dwelling with mortals that all these other great things flow from that reality. That God is making God's home with mortal men and women. All these other great things flow out of that one reality. A new heaven and a new earth, for example, are possible because God is making God's dwelling among mortals. Now, if we are saved, if we are resurrected, if we are in our new bodies, I'll have a new body, praise the Lord, I'll have a new life. If we are in that state of being, why not just fix up the old earth? It's fine, you know. That's what Baptists would do. You know, we're frugal with our money. Why go to all that expense? Let's just fix up what we have and we'll live with God and be happy. So why a new heaven and a new earth? I'm not really sure, but it symbolizes, I suppose, a new start and a new age. It's kind of like when kids leave their parents' home and they go out and buy or build their own home. It's a new start. It indicates a new beginning for the people of God. Plus, we got to admit, this old earth has a lot of miles on it. It's getting to be kind of high mileage. And unfortunately, a lot of that is because of what humans have done to the earth. Okay? We are the cause of a lot of the earth's ills. Now, I'm not getting into the controversies about global warming or anything like that, but I'm just saying we've done a lot of harm to this planet. And so God is going to start over. Besides, in the beginning, God wanted people to live in paradise, right? Well, God's plans haven't changed. So the earth and the heavens are going to get a reboot. We're going to get a reboot in computer terms. We're going to start over, and we're going to start over in the paradise that was interrupted by these few short millennia of sin. Because we will be perfect people, and God's going to want us to live in a perfect world. Therefore, a new heavens and a new earth. And then there's this phrase that, not being Jewish people, we have a tendency to pass over. There was no more seat. You know, I know the first number of times I read this passage, I'll go, oh, there's no more seat. Well, you know, so what? What's the big deal about there being no more seat? I have to admit, the first several times I read that, I didn't even give that any thought. So I, well, everything's going to be dry land. You know, whoop-de-doo, what's the big deal? The big deal is, if you remember Genesis, the earth was formed out of the primordial chaos. The earth, when it was first formed, was chaos. And God tamed and held back the chaos in order to create land and put living things on land and to eventually create human beings. If you read the Old Testament, particularly in some of the Psalms, it talks about God taming the Leviathan, the great sea monster. And the Leviathan in Old Testament thought, as well as in Canaanite mythology, was this great sea monster, this chaos monster that was the source of all human troubles. In other words, the sea represents sin and all the effects of sin and evil, all the suffering that comes from that. And so a Jewish person would have readily understood the implications of there will be no more sea. Chaos will and evil will have been finally defeated, and they will not be present anymore in God's new world. The Jews didn't like the sea. I think Solomon had a navy, if you read back. In the stories of Solomon in the Old Testament, he had a navy. He built a navy. But the Jews weren't great seafarers. They didn't like the sea because of these stories. And sometimes when they went to sea, it didn't work out so well. Think of Jonah. Going to sea didn't work out that well for Jonah. So I imagine a lot of Jews would say, see, if he had stayed on dry land, everything would have been fine, you know. There's no more chaos, no more evil. It's been defeated. And it's significant also that this New Jerusalem is a city. It says it's a new city. Now, I'm sure you all love coming to Boskydale to church. And I grew up in country churches, although I don't think I grew up in one. It's honestly, I'm not sucking up, but as pretty as this one with the rock formations out here, I mean, it really is the little white church in the dell. I mean, picture postcard church. I served one church in Georgia that was kind of like this, except it was on a busy highway, but it was a really pretty building. And for those of us who are small town and rural folks, I don't know if you were, but I was raised in a small town, outside of a small town, about 800 people. That's what Adrian, Georgia was, and I grew up on a farm, and we didn't like cities. We didn't want to go to the city. I can't drive in the city. You know, you would hear a lot of people say, and they would be talking about like Carbondale, not even St. Louis. You know, that would be just driving in Carbondale. I can't drive there. So some of us have grown up with an aversion to the city. And I've come to really appreciate cities over the years. London and I have been to a number of cities in the last few years, and I enjoy it. If we were to think of our ideal heaven, it would be, you know, maybe give me land, lots of land, you know, don't fence me in, you know, maybe something like that or a place like this. But no, the church started out in the Mediterranean basin due to Paul's travels. The church started out as an urban movement. Everywhere Paul planted churches was in cities. And it became a movement that started in the cities. So why a city? Well, for one thing, Jerusalem was considered to be a very holy city, the nexus of heaven and earth. They thought that was where heaven and earth met. It had a profound spiritual meaning to the Jewish people. But beyond that, a city implies people working together, people developing a community, people doing things together to improve the life of the people around where they live. And so maybe that's why God is going to make it a city, so that we can all Christians can live together as a community, as a group of equals, and we'll all have a part to play. So with it being a city, he's saying, I'm going to build you a community. I'm going to build you a community where everyone has enough, everyone can get along. I think, though, since chaos has been defeated, there will be some jobs that won't be needed. We won't need a neighborhood watch, you know. We won't need policemen. Maybe the police officers will become artists or bakers or something like that. Thank goodness we won't need that. Probably not nurses, maybe. I don't know. There will, because all of the bad things will be gone away. You know, so I guess we'll all be baking and putting on little French hats and painting landscapes or something like that. And some of you may think, oh, gosh, that's boring. You know, maybe some of you will get to work on muscle cars. I don't know. Maybe that would be your heaven. But it will be a place where everyone has fulfilling work to do, and we'll finally all be able to get along in community. The interesting thing is, mere mortals will be God's people. God could have created a community out of the angels, you know, but God's going to use mortals. And that's quite a miracle. Because think about us. Think about what's in our hearts and the things we say and do every day that are wrong. Unless you're not like me, maybe you're not. I hope so. I hope you're better than I am. That would be super. But if you think about the way we are and you think about the way God is, what a miracle that we mortal human beings get to be the people of God. And then we come to the part that we talk about so much at funerals, and it's so comforting. There will be no more suffering, death, crying, tears, pain, twisted ankles, no more bereaved families on prayer lists, no more people with cancer or heart problems or diabetes or gout. We won't need prayer lists. It'll be a place where they don't need prayer lists. Think about that. Think about so many things we have gotten used to from living in a fallen world. Prayer lists, ERs, jails, prisons, police stations, armies, dementia wards, rehab facilities. We've gotten used to so much evidence of fallenness and brokenness all around. I don't know what we'll do with ourselves. None of that will be there. Because you see, such suffering is a part of the old heavens and the old earth. The order of fallenness and sin and chaos and all of that has been defeated. The old order will be gone, and so will all the symptoms of living in that old order. No more suffering. No more suffering. I don't know if we'll still get colds or allergies. I was wondering this morning, maybe we might just have just enough to remind us of what we don't have to put up with anymore. You know, a cold that you get over in 5 minutes. I don't know. In Revelation, I think, 22, it says, the trees of the leaves are for the healing of the nations. maybe there will still need to be some healing. Some of the pain we carry in this life runs pretty deep. And even though we will be in a state of perfection, we may still need some healing. And that's going to be provided for if we do. I don't know. All this is speculation. I hope you realize that. Instead, the new order will be characterized by constantly renewed life and vitality. The streams of living water that run and run and run. To the thirsty, I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life. It symbolizes that life will be constantly renewed, constantly vital. We'll all have plenty of energy. If we have resurrected bodies like unto Jesus' glorious body, I suspect we'll probably sleep. We may still need to sleep. We'll get to sleep throughout the night. We won't have bladder control issues and have to get up 3 or 4 times during the night. Won't that be great? You know? Speaking particularly to some of the men in our group, that'll be super. I don't have that issue yet, but I'm looking forward to probably having it one day. Yay! Sorry. But life will be continually renewed because there won't be anything to harm us at all. Now, that's a great vision. And we need to understand that John didn't concoct this vision of the new world, the new Jerusalem, out of whole cloth. Again, remember, I think I said this. Revelation is a very Jewish book. It is built on the foundation of Jewish apocalyptic literature that you see throughout the Old Testament, like particularly Daniel, Ezekiel. Daniel has a lot of passages that are very similar to Revelation. And if you look in the Old Testament, and also if you look in some of the Jewish apocryphal literature, like books you may have heard of, like, you know, 1st and 2nd Esdras and Tobit and the Wisdom of Solomon and some of those apocryphal books that were written in the so-called intertestamental period, you see all kinds of hints of God's new world, God's new kingdom, a glittering city filled with jewels and brightness and light. It's all in there. I could give you a list of it, but if you want to look it up, you can look in the interpretation commentary for Revelation. The Presbyterians put it out. I'm sorry. You know, I've been hanging around with people like that the last few years. I hope it hasn't diminished my Christianity any, but the Revelation commentary is written by, get this, his name is Dr. Eugene Boring. Yeah, I want to sign up for a class with Dr. Boring. I hear he was a really good professor, but anyway, John didn't concoct this vision out of whole cloth, is what I'm saying. This vision of the new city, the renewed city of the people of God, this idyllic vision of the new Jerusalem had long been the dream of the people of God. That one day God would rule the world, would rule a kingdom of justice and peace and love. So John was just telling, particularly the Jewish Christians, your dream is going to come true. Indeed, this heavenly city was a dream of all the saints who have followed God's way over millennia. We're reminded in the book of Hebrews that they sought here no continuing city, but looked for one to come. They sought it by faith and persevered in the face of terrible trials and suffering. And finally, their dream will come true. And when I talk about the saints of the past, last Sunday was Reformation Sunday in the Christian church. I'm talking about people like Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli, and some of our Baptist saints like Isaac Backus and John Leland, Thomas Helwys, John Smith. If you don't know these names, get to know them. We owe them a great, great debt. Some names American Baptists should know would be like Adoniram Judson, Ann Hasseltine Judson, Luther Rice, some of those who began the American Baptist missionary movement. We owe them a great debt. We do live by the faith of our fathers. And they all dreamed of a city to come like this. They all dreamed of this day of coming, this glorious, wonderful day. But here's the thing. The saints of the past didn't wait until the great getting up morning to start trying to build a new world. No, the dream of the heavenly city spurred them on to strive mightily to build a better one here on earth until God brings this world into this state of perfection. And so the saints of the past and the saints of today have built churches, hospitals, schools, orphanages, homeless shelters, missions. Think of all the hospitals that have the name of a denomination on it. Presbyterian Hospital, Methodist Hospital, Baptist Hospital. Every city you go, you see hospitals that were built by Christian people. All the Catholic hospitals, St. Mary's, St. Elizabeth's, Good Samaritan, all of those. The saints of the past, as they were marching toward Zion, marching toward this new Jerusalem, weren't content to sit on their hands and wait for all these wonderful things to happen. They wanted to start a movement of God's kingdom here on earth and try to alleviate some of the human suffering. And so they did all these wonderful things, and they're still doing them through like Operation Shoebox and all the wonderful boxes that you have here that are labors of love by your people that will go around the world to help kids have a little brighter, brighter Christmas and brighter day. So I guess the moral of the story is that, yes, we're marching to Zion. We're marching to that new Jerusalem. It is a reality. It's going to be wonderful. Won't it be wonderful there, as an old hymn says. So as Jesus says, yes, lift up your heads. Your redemption draweth nigh. And that's a great promise. But lifting up your heads doesn't mean taking your eye off this world. Lifting your head up means to walk with confidence and faith. But if you take your eyes off this world, you may run into something and bump your noggin. You know? So lift up your head, but keep your eyes on the ground. Keep your eyes on this world until the time comes when that new one is made, because there's a lot for the saints to do in this life, like this ministry right here, until the day when the saints go marching in. Amen.